Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
When religion becomes organized, man ceases to be free. It is not God that is worshipped, but the group or authority that claims to speak in his name. Sin becomes disobedience to authority and not violations of integrity. These are the words of Indian philosopher Radhakrishnan. I discovered them in Dr. Robert J. Lifton's book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, a study of brainwashing in China. And I thought they would make a very good introduction to this bonus episode. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Welcome to this edition of Mindshift Podcast, where I'm going to be talking about how cults maintain control, how groups with undue influence, and of course, this includes Christian groups, fundamentalist Christian, evangelical Christian groups, which I've argued in other podcasts and some of my articles on Medium, that I believe it shares a great many characteristics with the cults. And if you want to find out my articles on Medium, you can have a look. I'll put them in the show notes. You can take a look there. I've written a couple of articles, one about the cult of personality of Donald Trump, as well as asking the question, is evangelicalism a cult? And I argue in that article that it shares a great many of the psychological tricks and tactics used by mainstream, well-recognized cults, as defined by psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, and experts on cults, people like Rick Ross and Stephen Hassan. If you read the books, if you read the articles, you begin to discover that there is a very small playbook, basically, of common features of both cults and groups with undue influence. Now, I'm going to be using that term, and it's basically, I found it in Stephen Hassan's work. It's an article on his BITE model. That's a B-I-T-E. It's an acronym that means B-I-T-E. It stands for Behavior, Information, Thought, and Emotional Control. And he unpacks basically how it is that cults maintain control and influence over their followers through those four tactics. And what we're going to try to do is to integrate those two with Robert J. Lifton's eight markers or eight characteristics of cults. Now, if you read chapter 22 of his book, Thought Reform, you will find that it's basically an expanded version of his, what he later wrote in an article in 1981 in, I think it was the Harvard Review magazine, something like that, when he was a lecturer there. He wrote an article called Cult Formation, which has become basically a classic. But as I read that article, I went back later and read the book, and I discovered, as I say, that in chapter 22, he actually has a lot more information. And what I find fascinating about comparing the two, the article and the book, obviously he wrote the article well after he wrote the book. I think the book came out in 1961, something like that, not long after the Korean War. And of course, I've talked about this before. This is the genesis of the book. He was basically in Hong Kong, coming back from an assignment. He was an army psychiatrist, and he started interviewing people who were survivors of communist Chinese indoctrination centers or prison reform centers where they had been brainwashed by communist Chinese people. And this was where the book came from. As he interviewed these people who had gotten out, and they were bewildered, they were lost, they were very confused, disoriented, because they were trying to reintegrate back into their old lives, as it were, or actually start over. Some of them had been living in China for many, many years. There had been missionaries, there had been doctors, professional people who had been living in China who were swept up in the kind of communist net as they started looking for scapegoats, people that they could blame for the American aggression into Korea as they saw it from their point of view. And so what they were doing was they were arresting people who were perfectly innocent, like I say, someone like a priest or a doctor who had been practicing for decades in China. These people largely were from Europe. They'd been living in China for many, many, many years, and they were swept up in this sort of dragnet and then indoctrinated, brainwashed, and coerced into signing ludicrously elaborate confessions about how they were spies, how they were agents of the imperialist Americans, and all the rest of it. And people in the West were panicking. They were freaking out because they were thinking, now, wait a minute, if the Chinese communists can take a completely normal and, in fact, highly educated person, a medical doctor or a priest with a PhD or something like that, and make them sign ludicrous, ridiculous confessions, confessing to almost anything, what's to stop them from doing the same thing to us and brainwashing people that, you know, like myself? And of course, the American government was freaking out about it because it was in the height of the Cold War. And so there was a big concern about what we can do about it. And I believe that this book by Robert Lifton was one of the first, if not the first, to do a detailed, in-depth psychiatric study of what had gone on. Now, out of that book, he basically took these techniques that he uncovered that were used by communist Chinese people that ran the prison camps, and he started to correlate that with the world of the cults. And in 1981, I think that's why he wrote the article in the Harvard Magazine, because he was seeing in the 1970s, particularly in North America, there was a huge explosion of cult groups in America, for sure. And so he was very concerned about this. And as he studied these cult groups that were coming up in America, he was seeing the overlaps and the parallels between what he had witnessed in these Chinese communist prisoners and the same people in these cults who were being indoctrinated, manipulated, and controlled. And so he wrote this article, Cult Formation. So what I'm going to do in this episode is I'm going to go through these eight steps, these eight markers of cults, and I want to explain to you and unpack a little bit about how these cults maintain control, how you may have been indoctrinated, manipulated, and how you can unpack and unpick the conditioning. Because as cult expert Rick Ross said, that's one of the most important things you can do as an ex-cult member, as a person who's come away from a group with undue influence, is education. Educate yourself as to how you were conditioned and controlled, how you were indoctrinated and psychologically manipulated, and that will stop you from jumping back into another group, which he says often does happen. Now, in this episode, I'm going to relate as much as I can. I'll try to give examples from the world I know, the world of fundamentalism, the world of evangelicalism, because as that's my background, that's what I've come out of, and I'm seeing more and more and more the connections between, as I say, evangelicalism and the world of the cult. So that's what I want to get into. I'll try to give as many examples as we go through these eight markers of cults and take a look, maybe if we have time, at some attributes of cult leaders and how it is that they do exercise such control. Now, this is the question I want to start with. How exactly is it that cult groups, cult leaders, and so forth maintain such high levels of control over their followers? And I think this is a real pressing question for people who are on the outside, who've never been part of a cult. They look at people in cults and they just wonder, how in the world could people do this? And something that Chris Shelton mentioned, he's an ex-Scientologist, he mentioned in our podcast a while ago that he said, it is a common misnomer that stupid people get sucked into cults. You know, how could I be so dumb? How could they be so stupid to get sucked in and recruited by a cult? But he said, that's completely not the case. A lot of times it's the most highly educated or the more highly educated people who get pulled into cults. It's about exploiting people's vulnerability. And so that's the issue. We've got to keep that in mind. How do they recruit people? And then how do they maintain such high level controls? And even when the cult leader makes incredibly outlandish claims, outright lies, requires his followers to enact more and more increasingly inappropriate and bizarre behaviors, or actually turn a blind eye to his. I mean, you think of examples, you know, cult leaders who have incredible control, they have such high levels of manipulation of their people, they will even, to the point of normalizing, quote unquote, economic exploitation, sexual abuse of members, even childhood sexual abuse. I mean, think about some of the examples. Warren Jeffs of the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, marrying child brides. David Koresh of the Branch Davidians that ended in such tragedy in Waco, Texas. But he was marrying, or he was having sex with young children, and this was all somehow accepted by the group. You think about Keith Raniere of the NXIVM sex cult. David Berg of the Children of God saying that children should experience sex as a matter of doctrine. And so this has led to incredible damage. And yet the people in the group are giving them their children to marry, to have sex with, as a part of the doctrine of the cult. Well, according to Robert J. Lifton, there's 8 ways in which cult leaders or groups with undue influence are able to maintain such control. It's a variety of means. And basically what he says in this book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, there's thought reform, as he calls it, or mind control. It involves 2 major elements, and it's important to kind of set the groundwork. On the one hand, number one is this issue of confession. It's all about exposure and renouncing past evil, quote-unquote. And the second element is re-education. And in the re-education process, it's the remaking or the remolding of the person, and it's in the image of the leader. It's in the image of the group, and we're going to see how this works. The people within the group are essentially vying to get the attention of the leader, to kind of climb their way up the cult pyramid, and the leader sits at the top of the pyramid, and this is what they're doing, is they're essentially remaking, they're being remade into the image of the leader. And this is something, again, that Chris Shelton talked about, is that this is why it's so difficult to reconstruct your identity after you leave the cult, is because your identity has been essentially formed into to reflect that of the leader of the cult. And so you've got to go back and reclaim and reconstruct your original identity, as it were, that was suppressed and redefined and remolded into the image of the leader. Now let's take a few minutes and define cult. What exactly is a cult? How can we define it? Now, let's take a look at what Janja Lalić, she's a sociologist, she's a cult expert, and actually ex-cultist herself. Cults, she says, have often the following 4 markers. She says, number 1, cults often display an all-encompassing belief system. Number 2, extreme devotion to the leader. Number 3, a reluctance to acknowledge criticism of the group or its leader. And number 4, a disdain for non-members. Now, how is this brought about? Well, she says these are accomplished through bringing a series of pressures to bear on the individual. What sorts of pressures? Well, she says psychological, emotional, and physical. In some cases, there's even physical pressure, which are aimed at both social control and individual change. And this is what Lalić says. This is how groups are able to do this kind of thing to maintain the control over their followers. It's about a series of pressures, psychological, emotional, and perhaps physical. And it's all about establishing a culture of social control, individual change. Now, in his paper, Cult Formation, 1981, as I was saying, Robert Lifton says there's 3 basic markers. There's 3 themes that are seen in many cults. He says, quote, certain psychological themes which recur in these various historical contexts also arise in the study of cults. Now, let's just stop for a minute. What he's talking about is he's tying the study of cults back with his study of communist China. And that's what he says. He says that these are psychological themes, and the historical context that he's referring to is the study he did of prisoners coming out of these prisoners coming out of communist China, and he's tying them into the world of the cults. And he goes on to say that cults can be identified by 3 characteristics. Number 1, a charismatic leader who increasingly becomes an object of worship, as the general principles that may have originally sustained the group lose their power. And number 2, a process I call coercive persuasion or thought reform. Number 3, economic, sexual, and other exploitation of group members by the leader and the ruling coterie. That's the group that's in charge that helps the leader do what he does. And I say he because most often you find that cult leaders are men. It's very rare to have a female cult leader, although it does happen. Most of the time, the leader is a man. And this is what you tend to see most often in the world of cults. Let's take a look at one more final definition of the cults. Eileen Barker, she's a sociologist of cults. She says, most of the time, cults display the following characteristics, the following 3 characteristics. She says, quote, together, cult leaders and followers create and maintain their movement by, number one, proclaiming shared beliefs and identifying themselves as a distinguishable unit. Number two, behaving in ways that reinforce the group as a social entity, like closing themselves off to conflicting information. And number three, stoking division and fear of enemies, real or perceived, end quote. Now, not only does this relate to mainstream, what we'd call like religious cults, but also political cults of personality as well. And we see this historically. Those are kind of political cults created by people like Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin. You think of the rallies that people like that used to hold. More modern examples would include North Korea, Kim Jong-un. The whole country is basically a political cult. And I argue in my article on Medium that Donald Trump is running essentially a personality cult together with blindly loyal followers. And so I would say that those three characteristics cited by Eileen Barker apply to those political cults as well. Now let's go on into Lifton's eight markers of cults. Let's unpack these and walk through them in series. So the first marker of cults, he says, is what he calls milieu control. Now, what is a milieu? Milieu is the context, the environment. So it's all about the control of all the communication within the environment, the milieu. Now, I think this correlates to Hassan's information control in his byte model. In other words, what we can do is plug in Hassan's byte model into this concept of milieu control. What he talks about in his byte model is this issue of information control, and he talks about how the group leader controls all the information that flows to the followers, and that's the I in the byte model. Now, what Lifton says, he says, quote, in such an environment, the milieu that is, individual autonomy becomes a threat to the group. There is an attempt to manage an individual's inner communication. Milieu control is maintained and expressed by intense group process, continuous psychological pressure, and isolation by geographical distance, unavailability of transportation, or even physical restraint. Often the group creates an increasingly intense series or sequence of events, such as seminars, lectures, and encounters, which makes leaving extremely difficult, both physically and psychologically. And this is from his article, Cult Formation. Now, I found it interesting as I've been reading through Stephen Hassan's book, which is called Combating Cult Mind Control. He describes his own experience getting into the Moonies cult back in the late 70s, early 80s. And this is exactly how he was recruited. He was invited to a very seemingly innocent seminar, a lecture, and it turned into an encounter. And the longer he got into it, the more he got into it, these encounters became more and more difficult for him to leave. And he would say to himself, you know, I'm not dumb. I'm not stupid. I can't believe that I'm getting into this. But the more he got into it, this is exactly how he was sucked into this cult, the Moonies. And when we go to the book, Lifton's book, he comments it's about two aspects of the flow of information. Number one, the totalist group, the cult, seeks to establish domain over the flow of information to the individual from the outside world. And then number two, one's communication within oneself. So you've got to police your own thoughts. And the group, the totalist group, is trying to stop the individual from receiving information from outside. And we hear this over and over again from people who were in cults, destructive cults, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Scientologists, and even evangelical Christians. It's harder for them to do now with the advent of the internet. But even then, you know, there's a lot of groups that will curtail the members' internet usage because they don't want the person finding out the truth, as it were, or at least entertaining doubts or questions about their cult or about their group. And they need them to police their own thought. Now, when we look at evangelicalism, for example, the world that I know, we see milieu control. I think we see it in the intense fervor of those worship services, that teaching by the pastor. What does it do? It's reinforcing the theology of the particular church, the particular denomination, whatever slant he or she is kind of coming at the Bible from, that community. Well, what it actually is, it becomes isolation. in the sense that it's sort of that Christian bubble. And we see that cults and churches alike, they control, they manipulate their followers by using information. They use emotional control both to create and maintain this milieu. And that's kind of like being inside the bubble. And this is something that Rick Ross said in our podcast. He said, it's very difficult to think critically. When you're plugged into that group, you're receiving their downloads of information, as it were. And it's only when you unplug and you physically leave and you psychologically walk away as well, can you begin to create that emotional, that physical space from that milieu to begin to think critically, to question, hey, what have I been taught? I've been taught to believe this is all true. And that is why I, as well as Rick Ross, would say that education becomes critically important. Once you've unplugged, how was I manipulated? How was I controlled? How was I indoctrinated and psychologically controlled by this group? So what's the effect on the individuals when you're in this milieu control? Well, Lifton comments, he says, quote, the most basic is the disruption of the balance between self and outside world. Pressured toward a merger of internal and external milieu, the individual encounters a profound threat to his personal autonomy. He is deprived of the combination of external information and inner reflection, which anyone requires to test the realities of the environment and to maintain a measure of identity separate from it. At this point, he is subject to the hostility of suffocation, the resentful awareness that his strivings toward new information, independent judgment, and self-expression are being thwarted, end quote. And this is what happens mentally to the person in the midst of this milieu control. And really, we have to step back, zoom back a little bit, and say, okay, so what's happening when you're in a cult, when you're in a group with undue influence, whether it be an actual mainstream cult that's recognized or a church, something like that, you're entering a milieu that is being managed and being controlled. And it does have an effect on your personal autonomy. You are actually having to suppress your own identity to fit in into the milieu of the group. All right, so let's move on. Number two in Lifton's 8 markers of cults is what he calls mystical manipulation or planned spontaneity. He refers to it also as the psychology of the pawn. And this now is a description of how milieu control works. He says, the process is managed so that it appears to arise spontaneously. To its objects, it rarely feels like manipulation. Religious techniques such as fasting, chanting, and limited sleep are used. And this is, you can again plug this right into the world of the cults or churches. You're being manipulated, but you don't know that you are being manipulated. Now, when we go back to the book, he elaborates on this. He says, quote, initiated from above, that is the leaders of the group, or the leader is the one who's controlling and manipulating the milieu. This milieu control, he says, seeks to provoke specific patterns of behavior and emotion in such a way that these will have appeared to have arisen spontaneously from within the environment. This element of planned spontaneity, directed as it is by an ostensibly omniscient group, must assume, for the manipulated, a near mystical quality. End quote. Now he goes on to talk a little bit more about this. He says, Lifton says, okay, those in control, they don't engage in this mystical manipulation solely for the purpose of maintaining power over their followers. What it's actually doing is it's inculcating a sense of higher purpose. It creates the feeling that they're instruments of their own mystique. And he goes on to say, they, that is the leaders of the group or the cult leader, they are the agents chosen by history, by God, or some other supernatural force to carry out the mystical imperative, the pursuit of which must supersede all considerations of decency or of immediate human welfare. So in other words, at the same time they're convincing themselves they're part of something bigger than themselves, the agents carrying out the mystical imperative, any thought or action which questions the higher purpose is considered to be stimulated by a lower purpose, to be backwards, selfish, and petty in the face of the great overriding mission. Now, once again, I think you can look at church worship service. This is This is a great example of something that's used as a means of planned spontaneity or this mystical manipulation. Think about it. Speaking in tongues, moving in the spirit, group activities like fasting, chanting, liturgy, worship, etc., etc. Mystical manipulation can also be used to characterize outsiders. They haven't seen the light. They're evil. It's okay to lie to them. It's okay to deceive them because, again, it's a higher purpose. That's okay. You know, and you look at the way a church worship service works, the leaders intentionally pick songs for the worship set. They are designed to take the worshipers on an emotional journey. You start out with a few fast, driving, kind of rocking songs. You slowly move the tempo down to a more contemplative, emotionally reflective music and lighting. And all these things are also used as part of that manipulation. And that's mystical manipulation. It seems spontaneous. It seems free-flowing, but it's actually carefully managed by those in charge. Now, what's the effect on the individual? Well, he points out that, quote, the psychological responses to this manipulative approach revolve about the basic polarity of trust and mistrust. One is asked to accept these manipulations on the basis of ultimate trust or faith, but such elemental trust is difficult to maintain. Even the strongest, he says, can be dissipated by the constant manipulation, end quote. Now, what happens when trust gives way to mistrust? In other words, you start questioning, you think, wait a minute, am I being controlled? Am I being manipulated in this milieu, this environment? Well, Lifton says, quote, the higher purpose cannot serve as adequate emotional sustenance. In other words, if you start thinking, wait a minute, this higher calling, all this stuff that I've been told that I'm a part of something bigger than myself, that's not enough to sustain me. And he goes on to say, the individual then responds to the manipulations through developing what I shall call the psychology of the pawn, feeling unable to escape from forces more powerful than himself, he subordinates everything to adapting himself to them, end quote. Now, what happens is you basically become part of the system. You can't take it anymore, and so you begin to subordinate everything so that you can fit in, so that you can adapt yourself to the group. And he says, when you begin to subordinate yourself to this larger purpose, you anticipate these environmental pressures, you become skillful in writing them in such a way that your psychological energies merge with the tide rather than turning painfully against yourself. And this is what happens. He says, whatever the response, whether you're cheerful in the face of being manipulated or if you're deeply resentful or there's a combination of both, what happens psychologically is you've been deprived of the opportunity to exercise your capacities for self-expression and independent action. So in other words, that person is losing his or her capacity to think critically, to think and act independently. So moving on in Lifton's model number three, the third marker of cults is what he calls the demand for purity. Now he points out that, quote, the demand for purity is a call for radical separation of good and evil within the environment and within oneself. Purification is a continuing process often institutionalized in the cult of confession, which enforces conformity through guilt and shame evoked by mutual criticism and self-criticism in small groups, end quote. Now, what is he talking about here? I see this all over the place, again, in evangelicalism, what we call the purity culture. Now, in Lifton's understanding of it, the demand for purity by the leaders of the group, it sharply divides. It's a black and white thing. It divides the experiential world into what he calls the pure and the impure, into the absolutely good and the absolutely evil. You see that black and white sort of thinking going on here. He says, all taints, all poisons which contribute to the existing state of impurity must be searched out and eliminated. What's called a Manichaean worldview. It's like a black and white polarity. Now, the idea that we're being sold in these cults and groups is that absolute purity is actually attainable. Whatever the group or the leaders say is the goal of that purity. Anything done to anyone in the name of this purity, says Lifton, is ultimately moral. Now think about some examples. Westboro Baptist Church in Kentucky. This is a fundamentalist cult. You can see this in the Louis Theroux documentary. They excommunicated two close family members for what? For doing what? Well, for the sin of getting caught wearing a bikini at the beach on holiday. And what happened as a result of this, when they found out these two girls had worn a bikini and violated the purity culture of the group, they did the right thing, these family members. They disowned them. They shunned their daughters. They completely wrote them out of their lives. They treated them as if they were dead for such a transgression of this purity culture. And that's an example. And we hear other examples, of course, again, of the evangelical purity culture, kids being forced, or it's not really forced, I guess. They're indoctrinated. They're pulled into this thing from day one, if they've grown up in the church, wearing purity rings, signing purity pledges, saying they're going to maintain their virginity until their wedding day, and it's all these great promises are thrown their way that the sex is going to be amazing and all this stuff. God's going to bless them. God's going to bless the parents for delivering that virginal son or daughter to the wedding altar. It's like a commodity, basically. And this is the purity culture that we see operating all over the place in evangelical and maybe even mainstream churches. But the reality, though, as Lifton points out, no one can realistically achieve such perfect purity. It's simply not possible. But it's critically important to understand in terms of the consequences for those who do transgress. And that's why it's so important in the milieu control of the cult or the group with undue influence, because ultimately it's going to be used as a tool or a weapon to control and manipulate people in the group. And so in terms of consequences, what Lifton says is, quote, "For by defining and manipulating the criteria of purity," see, the group is the one who says, the leader is the one who says, this is our standard, and we're going to control it, we're going to manipulate what that criteria is. He goes on and says, "And then by conducting an all-out war on impurity, the ideological totalists create a narrow world of guilt and shame. This is perpetuated by an ethos of continuous reform, a demand that one strive permanently and painfully for something which not only does not exist, but is in fact alien to the human condition," end quote. And we see this in evangelicalism, in accountability groups, and purity culture. They not only define what the criteria is, they then control what happens, and they can do this by tapping into your guilt and shame mechanisms. So what's the effect on the individual caught up within this purity culture, this demand for purity in these groups? Well, on this level of the relationship between the person and the environment, what he says is, it indicates that, quote, "the demand for purity creates that what we may term a guilty milieu and a shaming milieu." See, there's that guilt and shame mechanism. He says, "Since each man's impurities are deemed sinful and potentially harmful to himself and others, he is, so to speak, expected to receive punishment, which results in a relationship of guilt with his environment." So what happens then when the person fails to meet the prevailing standards of purity, which is, of course, set by the environment, set by the leadership of the group? Lifton says this is what happens. Quote, "He's expected to expect humiliation and ostracism, thus establishing a relationship of guilt with his milieu. Moreover, the sense of guilt and the sense of shame become highly valued. They are preferred forms of communication, objects of public competition, and the basis for eventual bonds between the individual and his totalist accusers," end quote. So in other words, you can simulate guilt and shame for a while, but eventually you're going to be found out. It's thus safer, the person eventually reasons to him or herself, to experience these feelings genuinely. And this is where we get into this issue of maintaining your inner thoughts and controlling your inner feelings. You better experience these feelings genuinely. You can't fake it and say, "I've done this and that small sin." No, you have to actually confess. And this is what happens in these groups. So how susceptible, this is the question, are people to this guilt and shame? Well, people vary. But both guilt and shame are basic to human experience and existence. And this is the problem. You're made vulnerable through your existential guilt, and therefore you are actually in a place to be controlled and manipulated. And Lifton says these groups are able to use guilt and shame. These are universal tendencies in all people. They're using them as emotional levers for controlling and the manipulation of the followers. And this is how this happens. So what happens to that individual? Well, when you're trapped within these manipulative poles of guilt and shame, well, you begin to apply the totalist polarization of good and evil to your own character. Parts of yourself are attributed with excess virtues, while other parts are excessively condemned. And he says that all impurities come to be seen as originating from outside influence, you know, from the ever-threatening world beyond the closed group. Therefore, he says, the one of the best ways to relieve yourself of some of the burden of guilt that you're feeling within this milieu is to denounce continuously and hostilely the same outside influence. So the more guilt equals the more hatred equals the more threatened the followers feel. So again, going back to evangelicalism, look at the evangelical purity culture around this issue of sexuality and modesty for sure. What happens is the group creates an us versus them mentality. Followers are deemed pure, those virginal, you know, Christians. Non-believers are impure. They're the ones out there having sex all over the place. They're watching porn. They're doing all the terrible things. So how are followers kept pure? Well, eventually they're going to stumble. They're going to do something wrong. Well, They can keep themselves pure. They can confess their sins. They can confess their wrongs to the group or to the leadership. What happens, though, if you go too far? If, for example, in the purity culture, you even do something as simple as wearing a bikini on holiday, or, heaven forbid, you actually have sex, well, you can be denounced. You can be ostracized by others in the group. And, of course, the world, they are seen as a corrupting and evil influence that's got to be denounced. They're the ones trying to lead us astray. And what I've heard from a lot of ex-cult members and ex-evangelicals, it's really, really difficult for those of us who have left kind of this totalist polarization of good and evil. It's hard to regain a sense of the balance to these complexities of human morality. It's not so simple. The world isn't such a black and white Manichaean sort of worldview. It doesn't work that way. And it's very difficult to get that back into some sense of balance. All right, so moving on, number four in his model is what he calls a cult of confession. Now, this is closely related to the demand for absolute purity, which is the number three marker of cults. And this is how they maintain this purity, the demand for purity. There's an obsession with personal confession. It's carried out beyond, as he says, the ordinary religious, legal, or therapeutic expressions to the point of becoming a cult in and of itself. So confession of your crimes, of things you haven't committed, sinfulness, it's artificially induced, all in the name of an arbitrarily imposed cure. Though the fact is, we're all susceptible to being manipulated, again, through those emotional levers of guilt and shame. But in the hands of the totalists, in the hands of the group or the leader, confession becomes a means of exploiting rather than offering solace for those all-too-human vulnerabilities. How does it actually work? Well, in this cult of confession, it takes on a number of kind of specialist meanings. Number one is it's a vehicle for personal purification. It's a means of maintaining that perpetual inner emptying, a psychological purge of impurity. And this is how the totalist group maintains its hold on your existential guilt. So if you sin, you can purge yourself of that impurity by confessing. Confess your sins to God. That's what we heard in Christianity. Number two, it's an act of symbolic self-surrender. It's where you merge the individual with his or her environment. And number three, it's maintaining an ethos of total exposure. What he says is it's a policy of making public, or at least known to the organization, everything possible about the life experiences, thoughts, and passions of each individual, and especially those elements which might be regarded as derogatory or negative. And I heard David Hayward say this in our recent podcast. He said that this accountability group thing that he was involved in, and I was involved in it too, it's all about maintaining this total exposure, being completely psychologically naked, as it were, in front of these people in your group. And eventually, though, in a culture like this, it gets out. Things get out. Things that you've confessed or even freely confessed in front of the group. If you're a preacher like I was, I gave examples of things where I had made mistakes. I was being exposed. I was told I needed to be transparent and open and honest, and these were, you know, negative things, and I was trying to relate them to the group and say, look, I've stumbled. I've had my share of sins, but what happened was they were ended up using them against me later, and this happens a lot in groups. Now, why is the cult of confession such a powerful tool for control? Well, first of all, at the beginning, it's genuinely helpful to the individual, at least in the sense that confession is genuinely emotionally cathartic. It helps rid yourself of suppressed feelings of guilt, and it brings relief. And this is something Chris Shelton said. Look at Scientology. You're going in to a center, a Scientology center, and you're getting audited. You're confessing a deeply suppressed and secret shame and things that you've hidden. And it's cathartic. If you feel better. You're getting rid of those feelings of guilt and shame, and it does bring that sense of emotional release and relief as well. There's also the possibility of genuine self-revelation and self-betterment by the true exposure of what I am as an individual. And again, something that David Hayward mentioned, it's wonderful to be in a community that I can confess everything, I can be who I am, and I'm still loved, I'm still accepted. And that seems like a wonderful thing at first, but as time goes on, what happens is the cult exerts more and more control over the individual. Ultimately, it can make use of those confessions to manipulate and control via those shame and guilt mechanisms. So in many cults, Lifton states, the cult of confession turns into what he calls histrionic command performances, where public display takes precedence over a genuine inner experience. It's a personal performance. Everyone becomes more concerned with their performance than they do about genuinely confessing a sin. It's a little more than acting. It's a performance. So ironically then, the cult of confession actually produces the exact opposite of its seemingly ostensible purpose, the notion of total exposure. Rather than eliminating personal secrets, it actually increases, it intensifies them because you're an actor acting as a role and you've got to hide the real truth about yourself. And so Lifton says it has two important elements, the personal secret part of it. First of all, he says guilty and shameful ideas, which one wishes to suppress in order to prevent their becoming known by others or their becoming too prominent in one's own awareness. And number two, representations of parts of oneself too precious to be except when alone or when involved in special loving relationships around this shared world. That is the milieu control of the church. Now, again, going back to the world of the church, we can see the cult of confession. It operates all the time within churches, as David Hayward and I were talking about, with things like accountability groups. What happens? People confess their sins to one another. It also involves people confessing sins of their pre-cult or pre-Christian life. And within evangelicalism, as I say, you see it in accountability groups, small group settings, even in the services themselves. Now, in extreme situations, I've heard this happen to people that I know. Some churches will actually make their members sit up front or sit in the middle of a circle of chairs while all the others hurl accusations. They make the person confess all their sins. And I know two people personally that this happened to in their church. Now, in the world of Scientology, Scientology leader David Miscavige, what does he do? He puts people in the hole who have done something to anger him or done something wrong, and only by confessing their sins, quote-unquote, can they be let out and let back into his good graces. So he uses the cult of confession, again, to control and manipulate people. Okay, moving on. Number five in Lifton's eight markers of cults is what he calls sacred science. What is sacred science? Well, he says it's important because a claim of being scientific is often needed to gain plausibility and influence in the modern age. Now, in the book, he goes on further. He says what sacred science is this. He says, quote, the totalist milieu maintains an aura of sacredness around its basic dogma, holding it out as an ultimate moral vision for the ordering of human existence, end quote. Now, how sacred is the science? Well, what it's seen is it's in prohibitions. that the group or the leader places against questioning its basic assumptions. Okay, so for example, in church, the reverence is demanded for those who wrote the Bible, those who bear the Bible, and for the Bible itself. All right, so you can't question these things. And so in evangelicalism and in many a mainstream church, sacred science is all around the Bible and the person who's the preacher of the Bible. And so it becomes put up on this pedestal, and you can't question what the preacher is saying because he or she is talking about sacred science, the Bible. And you could put inerrancy, inspiration, infallibility of the Bible into this area of sacred science. Now, what's the effect on the individual in this issue of sacred science? Well, Lifton says that the totalist sacred science can offer much comfort and security. Its appeal lies in its seeming unification of the mystical and the logical modes of experience. However, there's a downside to the whole thing too. He says, quote, "But the posture of unquestioning faith, both rationally and non-rationally derived, is not easy to sustain, especially if one discovers that the world of experience is not nearly as absolute as the sacred science claims it to be," end quote. Now, you talk about sacred science. This is the world that I came out of. The Bible was inspired. The Bible is infallible. It's inerrant. There's not a single mistake anywhere. Every jot and tittle, every word in the Bible is inspired, and there cannot be a single error or contradiction found. But that is really, really hard to sustain, especially when you start discovering, wait a minute, the real world doesn't operate like the Bible says it's going to operate. My experience doesn't match up with what I'm being told. And therefore, you have what is known as cognitive dissonance. What happens if somebody comes across a notion, an idea, a concept that tests or even contradicts the sacred science? Well, Lifton says, quote, "Yet so strong a hold can the sacred science achieve over his mental processes, that is, the group's follower who's buying into the line about the sacred science of the group." He says that if one begins to feel himself attracted to ideas which either contradict or ignore it, he may become guilty and afraid, end quote. So one's true quest for true knowledge, it's thereby hampered. Why? Because in the name of the sacred science, you're prevented from the genuine search for truth in line with a more objective scientific approach. So what happens is that the believer ultimately avoids, rather than really grappling with, the kinds of knowledge and experience necessary for genuine self-expression and for creative development. Look at the world again of Scientology. It's a clear example of sacred science in that L. Ron Hubbard's pseudo-scientific approach to mental health and psychology is really based on, I heard someone say, it's like the workings of a 1950s-era computer that somehow correlated to the human mind. He saw it as kind of a new approach to psychology and mental health. It's still rapidly defended by Scientologists today as the answer for all of humanity's problems. You think of the famous clip of Tom Cruise and Matt Lauer. Tom Cruise is just rapidly ripping psychiatrists and psychologists to shreds. Scientologists hate psychiatry, and they say that L. Ron Hubbard's book is the answer. And as I said before, in the church, you look at evangelicalism, scientific biblicism trumps the finding of modern science. We believe that the earth is 6,000 to 10,000 years old, young earth creationism and so forth. You know, look at the dogma of one church comparing itself to the other church just down the street or right next door. Our theology is correct. They're wrong. They're heretical. All that type of thing. So if you question the sacred science, it's either outright forbidden or at the very least, it's strongly discouraged. You could find yourself in real trouble if you start to question the sacred science of the group that you're a part of. Now, moving on, number six is what Lifton calls loading the language, loaded language, or what he calls thought-terminating cliches. What is a thought-terminating cliche? Well, it is seen as, quote, literalism and a tendency to deify words or image. A simplified, cliche-ridden language can exert tremendous psychological force, reducing every issue in a complicated life to a single set of slogans that are said to embody the truth as a totality, end quote. And in the book, Lifton expands on this. He says, quote, "The language of the totalist environment is characterized by the thought-terminating cliché. The most far-reaching and complex of human problems are compressed into brief, highly reducted, definitive-sounding phrases easily memorized and easily expressed. They become the start and finish of any ideological analysis," end quote. So in this loaded language, what he says is, quote, "It's repetitiously centered on all-encompassing jargon, prematurely abstract, highly categorical, relentlessly judging, and to anyone but its most devoted advocate, deadly dull. In Lionel Trilling's phrase, the language of non-thought," end quote. Now, the truth is, every organization has got its own insider jargon. You look at scientists, mathematicians, psychiatrists, they've got their insider jargon, absolutely. But the loading is much more extreme, he says, in ideological totalism. Why? Because the jargon expresses the claimed certitudes of the sacred science. That was the step before. In other words, what's it loaded with? Well, it's loaded with, it conveys the certitude of the dogma of the organization. That's what makes it loaded language. Now, what is the effect on the individual in this sense of using the loaded language of the totalist group? Well, he says, quote, "The effect of the language of ideological totalism can be summed up in one word, constriction. He is, that's the follower of the group, so to speak, linguistically deprived. And since language is so central to all human experience, his capacities for thinking and feeling are immensely narrowed," end quote. In other words, the person may not feel chained or feel restricted, but is nonetheless, in effect, confined and bound up by what he calls verbal fetters or verbal chains. Now, at first, when you encounter a group like this, and I'll give you some examples of this in a minute, there's a feeling of insight. There's a feeling of security. Hey, this is true. I'll just say this phrase. Whenever I'm having a doubt, I'll just shove this loaded language in there. There's this insight. But that is then often followed by feelings of uneasiness. Surely the person starts to think, all the complexities of life can't be reduced to simple platitudes, can they? Well, Lifton comments, he says, quote, "This uneasiness may result in a retreat to rigid orthodoxy, in which an individual shouts the ideological jargon all the louder in order to demonstrate his conformity, hide his own dilemma and his despair, and protect himself from the fear and guilt he would feel should he attempt to use those words and phrases other than the correct ones," end quote. Now, loaded language, I think, is probably the most clearest example of what's called Christianese, also referred to as God terms. I think it's the most clear example of how evangelicals and even mainstream church correlate to the world of the cults. This is probably the clearest example I've ever heard. What Christianese does is it reduces complexities down to simplistic single-sentence cliches. What it does is it closes down thought, it closes down critical thinking. So you say things like, well, you know, God's in control, God's ways are mysterious, all things work together for the good, for those who love God. Those are loaded language. That's Christianese. And we see this as well in cults. You know, if you ask a cult member, they'll use loaded language. If you ask someone a difficult question about their organization, their theology, the teachings of the groups, you know, they'll simply answer, well, if you confront a Jehovah's Witness, you say, what about the changing dates of Armageddon? How many times has the Watchtower predicted the end of the world and given specific dates? They'll just go, well, that's New Light Revelation. Now, the changing dates, you know, that precedes the old light. That's what it is. If you ask a Mormon of how they can be so sure about the complete lack of historical and archaeological evidence in South America for the Book of Mormon, they'll just say, well, I have a burning in the bosom. I know it's true. And that's the end of the discussion. That's loaded language. And that's what happens in these totalist cults, in these groups. Okay, so number 7 in our model, or Lifton's model, is what he calls doctrine over person. What is doctrine over person? He says, quote, "The principle of doctrine over person is invoked when cult members sense a conflict between what they are experiencing and what dogma says they should experience." That's that sacred science. The internalized message of the totalistic environment is that one must negate that personal experience on behalf of the truth of the dogma. Contradictions become associated with guilt, doubt indicates one's own deficiency or evil, end quote. And going on into the book, he says that doctrine over person is, quote, the subordination of human experience to the claims of doctrine, end quote. It's all about doctrinal primacy, that sacred science. When it comes to the goal of changing people, this is how this works. He states that, quote, the demand that character and identity be reshaped, not in accordance with one's special nature or potentialities, but rather to fit the rigid contours of the doctrinal mold, end quote. How does it work? He says, quote, the underlying assumption is that the doctrine, that sacred science, including its mythological elements, is ultimately more valid, more true, and real than is any aspect of actual human character or human experience, end quote. So what is the effect of doctrine over person on the individual? This is where we get into this issue of your own identity and your own sense of integrity. When you're put in what he calls a doctrine-dominated pressure environment to change, there's an intense struggle with your own sense of integrity. It's a struggle, he says, which takes place in relation to polarized feelings of sincerity and insincerity. So in a totalist environment, absolute sincerity, quote unquote, is demanded. He says the major criterion for sincerity is likely to be one's degree of doctrinal compliance, both in regard to belief and to direction of personal change. Now, what happens if you retain an alternate view of reality? How long are you going to be able to uphold a different view when you're being manipulated and controlled? Well, there's three different factors here. First of all, number one, how strong was your previous identity before you joined the group or the cult? That depends on how long you're going to last. Number two, the degree of penetration of the milieu by outside ideas. In other words, the more information control, the more likely the group is going to be able to manipulate you and, you know, reduce your alternate view of reality. And then number three, how much capacity does the person have for eventual individual renewal after they leave the group? And I guess that's a way to define a person's journey of reconstruction after they walked away from it all. How much of their original identity did they retain before they joined the group? How much information was leaked into them when they were in the group? And then what's their capacity for renewal after they've left the whole thing? So each person's journey is his or her own, for sure. Now, the final marker of cults is what Lifton calls the dispensing of existence. What this involves, according to Lifton, is this. He says, quote, those who have not seen the light and embraced the truth are wedded to evil, tainted, and therefore, in some sense, usually metaphorical, lack the right to exist. That is one reason why a cult member threatened with being cast into outer darkness may experience a fear of extinction or collapse, end quote. That's from his article in Cult Formation. Now, when we go into the book, he elaborates a bit further on this. He states, quote, the totalist environment draws a sharp line between those whose right to existence can be recognized and those who possess no such right, end quote. The world is divided into two types or classes, and we see this both in cults and churches. There's an us versus them mentality, those on the outside and those on the inside. They're the privileged ones. They're the ones in the know. They are receiving the truth from the leader or the group. Now, this is a question. Can outsiders become a part of the inside group? Yes, it's possible. But, he says, quote, the thought reform process is one means by which non-people, those are the outsiders, are permitted through a change in attitude and personal character to make themselves over into people, the insiders, end quote. So it is possible for an outsider to become part of the inside group, but the point is this. Who's so presumptuous as to appoint themselves as true arbiters and dispensers of human existence? Who imposes this distinction on people into two classes, the insiders and the outsiders, the us versus them? It's actually very arrogant, I think, to be in that position, the self-appointed position, to tell other people what their eternal destinies are going to be with 100% certitude. Now, in order to be in this lofty position, Lifton says, one underlying assumption makes that arrogance mandatory. He says, quote, the conviction that there is just one path to true existence, just one valid mode of being, and that all others are perforce invalid and false totalists thus feel themselves compelled to destroy all possibilities of false existence as a means of furthering the great plan of true existence to which they are committed. End quote. Now, looking at this dispensing of existence, what's the effect on the individual? Well, he says, quote, the polar emotional conflict is the ultimate existential one of being versus nothingness. He is likely to be drawn into a conversion experience, which he sees as the only means of attaining a path of existence for the future, end quote. Thus, the totalist environment stimulates a total fear of annihilation or of extinction in the follower. One can only overcome this fear and find confirmation only in the fount of all existence, the totalist organization. We could put in the word cult, church, whatever. Now, what happens in such a system? He says, quote, existence comes to depend upon creed. I believe, therefore I am. Upon submission, I obey, therefore I am. And beyond these, a sense of total merger with the ideological movement, end quote. Now, the key to the whole thing is this. The key factor is the idea that one is actually retaining some independent sense of his or her personal identity to some extent. What happens, though, if one strays too far along the erroneous or false path, one's right to existence may be withdrawn by the group or by the leader. You no longer deserve to have a part in this group. Now, examples of dispensing existence, that they've been seen historically. You talk about Nazi Germany, Stalin-era Soviet Union. It literally meant, the dispensing of existence meant that people that were labeled heretics to the state or enemies of the state, in the words of Stalin, they were literally killed or imprisoned in gulags or concentration camps in Nazi Germany. Now, in cults, it usually doesn't go that far, although sometimes it does. People can be put in the hole, like my example of David Miscavige from Scientology. Usually, though, what we see are such tactics like shunning, being disfellowshipped, being labeled an apostate by Jehovah's Witness, a suppressive person in Scientology, their fair game policy, the idea of disconnecting. These are used oftentimes to control cult members through the fear of being excommunicated. They're going to be shut off. Listen, if you leave, all your friends, all your family will be no longer able to communicate with you. You'll be written off. You'll be labeled an apostate. You'll be shunned. You'll be disconnected. And that is how they control and manipulate people still within the system. Now, look at Jim Jones. What happened in Guyana? That's probably the more extreme example. Jim Jones in Guyana, he literally presided over this dispensing of existence. This was a suicidal mystique that he made this pact with these people. And we saw it as well in the Branch Davidian cult, the UFO-obsessed Heaven's Gate cult, mass suicide in California in 1997. So the dispensing of existence in these extreme examples with literally the deaths of dozens or hundreds, in the case of the Jim Jones cult, of people. Their existence was literally dispensed. But in most cults, most churches, what you're going to find is if you question the party line, if you question the sacred science, if you try and retain a sense of your own identity a little bit too much, if you don't confess enough, or if you're found out to be a fraud, then you will discover the dispensing of existence. You'll be shunned, you'll be written off, or if you just leave the group, in many cases, you're done. Family members and friends will shun you, disfellowship you, write you off as an apostate. They will cut you out of their lives. And we hear about this happening literally all the time. All right, so I've just gone through Lifton's 8 markers of cults from his article, Cult Formation, which, as I explained, is actually a condensed version of chapter 22 in his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. And my sincere hope is that has helped you kind of unpack or unpick maybe some of the conditioning. Some of the examples that I gave hopefully will resonate with your own experience. Now, I wanted to take a few minutes here and at the end look at some examples of cult leaders. I want to talk about how it is specifically that cult leaders maintain control. What's the profile of a cult leader? How does it all work? We've kind of talked about some of the specific things in terms of Lifton's model of thought reform, the psychology of totalism, but I found an article on Apologetics Index. And what they did is they actually adapted a few principles from Lalich and Tobias's book, which is called Take Back Your Life. How are cultic power structures maintained? How are cult leaders able to control and manipulate their followers? Now, I don't know about you, but I am absolutely fascinated by how this works. And according to Lalich and Tobias, there are four basic systems of control or structures of control. Number one is what they call charismatic authority. Now, how does charismatic authority work? Well, it's an emotional bond between a leader, as I said before, usually a man, and his followers. What it does is it lends legitimacy to the leader and it grants authority to his actions while at the same time justifying and reinforcing the followers' responses to the leader and or the leader's ideas and the goals. What they say is that charisma, it's the hook. It links a devotee to a leader and or his ideas. The general purpose of charismatic authority, they say, is to provide leadership. The specific goal is for the leader to be accepted as the legitimate authority and to offer direction. How is this done? Well, it's accomplished through privilege and command. The desired effect, of course, is that members will believe in and identify with the leader. The second marker or the second power structure in cults is transcendent belief system. What it is, it's the overarching ideology that binds the followers to the group, and it keeps them behaving according to the group's rules and norms. Why is it transcendent? Well, it's transcendent because it offers a total explanation of the past, the present, as well as the future. And that's really important because it's all about the path to salvation that's offered by that particular group. Now, most importantly, the leader or the group also specifies the exact methodology or the recipe for the personal transformation necessary for you to travel on that path to salvation, the salvation that they alone can provide. The goal of the transcendent belief system is to provide a worldview that offers meaning and purpose through some sort of moral imperative. Now, this imperative requires each member to subject him or herself to a process of personal transformation. What's the desired effect? It's for the member to feel a sense of connection to the greater goal. There's that higher purpose while I'm aspiring to salvation. You see how that works? Now, the effect is solidified through the internalization of the belief system and its accompanying behavior and attitudes. Moving on, the third characteristic is systems of control. This is the network of acknowledged or visible regulatory mechanisms that guide the operation of the group. It includes the overt rules, regulations, and procedures that guide and control members' behavior. The purpose of the systems of control is to, quite simply, provide organizational structure. Now, there's a specific goal. It's to create a behavioral system and disciplinary code through rules, regulations, and sanctions. The effect is compliance, they say, or better still, obedience. Now, moving on to the fourth and final characteristic of cult leaders is what they call systems of influence. This is the network of interactions and social influence that resides in the group's social relation. So the interaction, the group culture, what it does is it teaches members to adapt their thoughts, their attitudes, their behaviors in relation to their new beliefs. The purpose of the systems of influence is to shape the group's culture. There's a specific goal here, and that's to create institutionalized group norms and an established code of conduct by which members are expected to live. Now, it's accomplished by various methods, peer leadership pressure and so forth, and through social psychological influence and modeling. What's the desired effect? It's conformity. It's the self-renunciation that is required not only to be a part of the group, but also to achieve the professed goal, that salvation that the group or the leader is offering. Now, what's interesting, the article goes on to comment. They say, quote, "This combination of transcendent belief systems, all-encompassing systems of interlocking structural and social controls, and highly charged charismatic relationships between leaders and adherents result in self-sealing systems that exact a high degree of commitment as well as expressions of that commitment from its core members. A self-sealing system is one that is closed in on itself, allowing no consideration of disconfirming evidence or alternative points of view." It concludes by saying, in the extreme, a self-sealed group is exclusive and its belief system is all-inclusive in the sense that it provides answers to everything. Typically, the quest of such groups is to attain a far-reaching ideal. However, a loss of sense of self is all too often the byproduct of that quest, end quote. And so I think that provides a pretty helpful overview of how cults and how cult leaders are able to maintain that kind of control over their followers. Now, looking a bit closer at Lalich and Tobias's book, Take Back Your Life, let's look at some of the characteristics of cult leaders. What they say is that almost every cult leader, they have these kind of troubling defects in their personalities. They're kind of prime candidates for abuse. In other words, what kind of a person becomes a cult leader? Now, I found this really interesting. They say that cults exist to serve the needs of the leader, be it sexual, emotional, or financial, or some combination of one, two, or all three. And this is what I find so fascinating. Looked at from a historical point of view, these sort of markers of cult leaders apply to almost every single one. You could go back to Joseph Smith, who founded the Mormon Church, Charles Taze Russell, who founded Jehovah's Witnesses, Jim Jones, Charles Manson, David Koresh, David Berg, Marshall White of the Heaven's Gate cult, political cults, Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, even Donald Trump. They tend to kind of project these characteristics, and they say there are at least four characteristics that almost every cult leader exhibits. Number one is they are narcissistic. Number two, they are authoritarian. Number three, they are charismatic. They kind of project that winning personality. And what that does is it not only attracts attention to themselves, it'll build a following. And what the followers will feel like is, I'm sharing in the winning. So that charisma of the leader is really attractive. And then number four, they are sociopathic. And they list 15 characters of sociopaths that I'm not going to take the time to go into right now, but I do list them in my article on the personality cult of Donald Trump. And what we find is this really works. There's classic markers of cult leaders. I found an article in GQ magazine by Rebecca Nelson. It was on the cult of Trump, but she goes into the same thing. She says, first of all, cult leaders are fueled by charisma. Okay, the most salient feature of cult leaders is a person who essentially becomes an object of worship. He is typically the defining element of the group. He's the heart of the movement. He's seen as an inspiring person. He's able to help others with their lives, with their problems, on the path to salvation, whatever. And that's what fuels not only the cult leader, but the group itself. And she says, number two, the cult leader is a raging narcissist. Everything is about himself. The leader is the center of the universe. Everything revolves around them. They'll have this narcissistic personality disorder. What she says is it's an exaggerated sense of self-importance, preoccupation with success, power, brilliance, behaving in a haughty or arrogant manner. I heard an ex-cultist say, she said, you don't friend the leader. The leader friends you. In other words, in these cults, leaders tend to become unapproachable. They're aloof. Only those who are as friends or close associates, they're allowed to move up the hierarchy and into that inner circle of his close friends. And this is obviously appeals to his sense of narcissism. Number three, she says, what the leader says is always right, even when it's not. So even when confronted with definitive proof of the leader's lies, it doesn't matter at all to his followers. And this is something Chris Shelton said. It's like a force field. The leader somehow creates a bubble or a filter or a field around his followers, whereby they are just incapable of seeing reality as people on the outside do. And this is what she calls it's like a reality distortion field. And she comments that even when the leader's followers are presented with indisputable evidence of the leader's lies, their broken promises, whatever it might be, they'll either respond with indifference or disbelief. Such is the level of indoctrination and brainwashing to which they've been subjected. Now, looking a little bit more in detail in this, I came across another article by Randolph Hearst, and he says there's a couple of more markers of cults and cult leaders. Number one, cult leaders create a cult of personality. It's this us versus them mentality. And what he says is, quote, like religious cult leaders, demagogues understand the importance of setting up an in-group, out-group dynamic as a means of establishing their followers' identity as members of a besieged collective. You know, it's us versus the world. It's us versus them. The cult leader instinctively understands how indispensable his own individual persona is for his ultimate goal of both grasping and maintaining power. They've got this innate, this incredible ability to cultivate a public image which is completely often at odds with their private selves, one that they desperately need to hide from the public or even their followers. And number two, Hearst says, is that cult leaders paint themselves as a messiah figure. Only they can save their follower. And what you see in this type of thing is the leader often will paint a picture of a world of carnage. It's an Armageddon scenario that only they can fix, only they can solve, only they offer salvation. What they do then is then they isolate their followers in a bubble whereby only they control the flow of information. Reality only exists through the lens of their rose-tinted glasses. All other competing sorts of information are dismissed or denigrated. You know, for example, Trump will say fake news. You know, so this is how the cult leaders tend to do this. They can operate according to this sort of Manichaean worldview. I mentioned this before. It's a moralized battle between good and evil. It's a binary way of thinking. It's a black and white worldview. And according to an article I found online, it says, to be Manichaean is to follow the philosophy of Manichaeism, which is an old religion that breaks everything down into good or evil. To Manichaeans, life can be divided neatly between good or evil, light or dark, or love or hate. When you think Manichaean, think two. In other words, cult leaders succeed in establishing this us versus them mentality in their followers. Thus, morality, good and evil, right and wrong, etc., are reduced to simplistic categories, this black and white thing. And you see this, another marker is people-centric. They display this romanticized version of the popular will. In other words, somehow, even though he stands in as a messiah figure, he needs the help of his followers to accomplish his mission or the purposes of the organization or whatever. And a lot of times you see this anti-elitism. The leader will blame the people's difficulties on a malign establishment. That subverted the system for your benefit. I think a lot of cult leaders make use of this. You see cult leaders talk about conspiracy theories. You know, they are out to get us. They are out to destroy our lives. They're going to ruin our country. They're going to take away our religious freedoms or whatever it might be. You look at fundamentalists like Jerry Falwell Sr., his moral majority back in the 70s and 1980s. He made a great living playing on people's fears. He played on their prejudices. You know, he would send out newsletters, you know, to fundamentalists and evangelical Christians railing about the gay agenda and the atheists that are trying to take prayer out of public schools and Bible study out of public school. They're trying to kick God out of public schools. Unless we do something, we've got to elect these certain officials. We've got to elect people like Ronald Reagan, who's going to help us achieve our ends. And if you help me out, we're going to beat these enemies that we have, the gays, the abortionists, the atheists, the people who are intent on ruining the country. And what people like Falwell did, they succeeded in motivating their fundamentalist base to take action, to defeat the enemy. So they endorsed candidates and so forth. And this is what we see, for example, in that 81% white evangelical vote voting for Donald Trump. Even that is still being used as an emotional lever, controlling people, manipulating them by appealing to their fear and their anger. And that, of course, explains why candidates like Reagan and Trump got elected. And in some cases, the fundamentalists even helped to defeat more liberal candidates who with smear campaigns and destroying their reputations. So that's just kind of an overview of how cult leaders sort of function, how they control people, how it works. And I've been thinking a lot about this issue of milieu control, going back to Robert Lifton's model, the 8 markers of cults. I think the whole issue of milieu control, that's really the whole ball game. I think it's the sense that, like, it's a giant circle. It overlaps all the other 7 characteristics that Lifton outlines. So into that milieu control, for example, we could fit Stephen Hassan's BITE model: behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control. That works within the milieu control of Lifton's model. And I think the key word in both Hassan and Lifton's model is control. In other words, look at what happens. The church or the cult is seeking to have control over its members, over its followers. It does so in a wide variety of ways. And this is what Lifton talks about in the other 7 markers of cults after milieu control. For example, churches use both doctrine. They use psychological manipulation to accomplish their purpose. Now, we can deconstruct the psychology. We can even split that out from the doctrine. And I think many ex-evangelicals, they do have a lot of issues with Christian or biblical teachings. But it's important to know that, look at churches, how they operate. Doctrine is often used as a means of putting psychological pressure on people. I was asking people on Twitter not long ago about this. Can you separate the doctrine from the psychological manipulation that you experience while in evangelicalism? And a lot of people said, yeah, in theory you can, but the truth is that oftentimes a doctrine like hell, for example, that's often used then to coerce and manipulate people into converting into Christianity. Fear of being left behind in the rapture, that's brought many a terrified convert like me when I was a kid watching that movie A Thief in the Night. That's what brought me into the church. That's what made me want to become a Christian. I was terrified and I was so full of anxiety and fear that I was going to be left behind that I desperately wanted to make sure that wasn't going to happen. And think about it. This type of thing, it can bring a lot of religious trauma. You know, think, for example, of the child, the one who's being spanked, and we would say abused by his or her evangelical or fundamentalist parents. All the while, they're being told, listen, God demands this of us, your parents. The Bible says that if we spare the rod, spoil the child. It's for your own good. I'm only doing this because I love you. It's all justified, as, for example, the cult leader Bill Gothard did, by arguing that spanking is God's means of breaking the will of the child, and that will become a major deterrent on his or her proclivity to sin and rebel against God, which is equal to the sin of witchcraft. So, of course, why wouldn't you want to do that? So, thus, not only does the child, and perhaps later as an adult, you've got to deal with the trauma of the physical abuse, as well as the psychological pressure that you endured from your parents, there's also the added dimension of having to unpick the conditioning that somehow God was behind it all. He required your parents to carry out such abuse in sort of a means justifying the ends sort of theology. So when you look at how this works, how cults and leaders maintain control, how groups with undue influence maintain and manipulate their followers, you got to go back and unpick and unpack the conditioning. How were you controlled? How were you manipulated? How were you coerced into doing certain things, saying certain things, suppressing your identity and becoming a completely different person? And then, as Lifton says, when you start to reconstruct, you've got to go back and find the original identity, as it were, that was suppressed and denied and even done a lot of damage to during your time in the cult or in the group. And this is where education is so hugely important. And I hope that this episode has helped you to go back and unpick and unpack the conditioning. And it's helped you to kind of walk through how I was controlled, how was I manipulated in my time in the group. I'd love to hear your thoughts and your comments and your feedback on this bonus episode. You can contact me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can find me on Facebook on the MindShift Podcast Facebook page, or you can connect with me in a couple different ways, and I'll put those in the show notes as well. Hopefully this has been a beneficial bonus episode for you. I'm interested in finding out how it's helped, so let me know what your thoughts are on this episode of How Cults Maintain Control. I'll see you in a couple of weeks, maybe again, for another bonus episode here on Mindshift Podcast.